Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. And frankly, even though this is not in my script, I will say sometimes the lack of changes in our society and how they affect us. So that those are the things that we look at here. If you've been with us for the last few weeks, you are aware that as part of an NPR project, we have been talking about you, me, and experiencing discrimination in America. 2 weeks ago, the topic covered African Americans and how they saw discrimination. Last week, it covered Latino communities and how they saw discrimination. Next week, it will include the Native American community. And yes, I'm kind of dancing around this because this week it includes how white Americans perceive discrimination. We're working on this as part of the as other member stations are for a series called You, Me, and Them, Experiencing Discrimination in America. This program is rooted in a national poll that was done by NPR in collaboration with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The unique survey looked at 3,400 respondents and asked them about how they perceived discrimination, but it looked at them in a different fashion than we may have thought about studies like this a lot. It didn't specifically ask them or focus mostly on what they thought about discrimination or racism or any other word you want to drop in there. It actually focused on their talking about whether or not they had personally experienced anything like that in their own life. And that became a large discussion. Today's topic is how white Americans look at discrimination, but I want to clarify that it's not how white Americans look at discrimination of other subgroups in the community. It's how white Americans look at the issue of discrimination as a broad topic for them. It's difficult to figure out how you fit this into the overall scheme of things. It was difficult for those of us reading the studies, of which there are copious quantities of material, to try and get a view about how this is. Let me tell you that I've got a few more things to add to the discussion before we get too far along, but I want to let you know that my guests today are Mark Skinner. He's basically, by the way, everybody in the room and on the phone is a white American. That's for clarification, because I wanted to clarify that, because among other things, Mark Skinner is a board member of the newly reformed chapter of the NAACP. Yes, the NAACP welcomes people of diverse backgrounds and diverse races within their organization, and that's a factor. Our other two guests are Michael Latner. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Cal Poly and currently the Kendall Voting Rights Fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mike is going to be on the phone with us. He is in Washington at the Union of Concerned Scientists now, because even though he gets to commute back and forth from here on occasion, he is there right now. And Stu Jenkins. Stu Jenkins is a local attorney. And he basically has a background in both family law and estate planning, but he also has been known to represent people with regard to civil rights cases, and we're going to talk about that. He is also currently the president of the San Luis Obispo County chapter of the ACLU. He did tell me that he's the outgoing chair or president of that, because he has found someone else to take that position on also. This is a topic that is interesting, because I will preface our conversation with the fact that we have invited people that we would specifically classify and see as significantly right of center in their view, who are white Americans, to be part of the program with us. And most of those, if not all of them, either found a reason to not participate or specifically gave us an excuse why they weren't available. I preface that with that information because I believe some folks will feel like we have a rather liberal speaking body talking about this topic, and it's not because we didn't try and get a more diverse speaking body to talk on this topic. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, the phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. I would specifically like to hear from any callers who can give us a constructive observation about the ways in which they've been discriminated against if they are members of the white community. Of course, the discussion is also open to anybody who wants to be part of the discussion. An interesting side note is, as I look at the information from this study that was done with over 3,400 respondents across the country, is when we look at the number of people who feel that they have been discriminated against in their life at some point, 92% of African Americans feel that way, 78% of Latinos feel that way, 75% of Native Americans feel that way, 61% of Asian Americans feel that way, 90% of LGBTQ members feel that way. But surprisingly for me, and more surprising for a lot of folks, I think, is that non-Hispanic white Anglo-Americans, 55% of that population feels like they have been discriminated against somewhere within their life, and we can get into more details about that. Stu, let me start with you. When we presented this information to you and asked you about participating in this program, did any of this surprise you, and how did you read it when you first looked at it?
Well, I got this study yesterday, and I looked through it, and I think my first impression was that there's a lot of time spent on studies. And I think if you take a look at some of the details of the survey, what you really find out is that people who are surveyed are basing their feelings on what they see right in front of them, what they've experienced. And I think anybody, at least anybody my age, you guys are probably younger.
Stu, I'm the oldest guy in the room.
has seen that racism, sexism, ethnicism, bias is a condition that is shared by almost every kind of human group on the planet. And, of course, whenever there's racism, it breeds racism. And so to the extent that we can evolve in our thinking and in our and really focus in on our moral compasses to understand that every person counts, whether you look at the Bible or the Constitution or the Torah or the Koran or the writings of Buddha, you can overcome those kinds of things and really start to accept others, and by accepting others, you set a better example.
So that's very, very good point. Very good point. Michael, you've been part of this discussion for a long time. You and I have known each other for quite a while. You've been on the program with me three or four times, and you were here 2 weeks ago in person at that time when we talked about the issues of African Americans' feeling of discrimination on this topic. Did the results with regard to the white population surprise you, or how do you feel they fit into your view of the country and the geopolitical social aspects of our country?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I think that your last statement, the geopolitical context, is something that is more important as a reflection of this survey than possibly even more than people's own experiences. As Stu pointed out, certainly we have to respect the way that people convey their experiences and the way that they express their understanding of racism in a survey context. But what I found most surprising, looking into the subgroups of the white population, is that unlike the Latino survey and the African American survey, you're seeing experience not actually play as much of a role. So, for example, when you look at the subgroups, there aren't that big of differences by income. There aren't that big of differences. The biggest differences are by education, but the biggest difference overall, the single group that is most likely to say that they believe that there is racism against whites are people who identify with the Republican Party, 74% compared to 28%. That's the highest group among any other demographic, whether it's education or income. So I think that the political context is key. This is not simply a reflection of people's own day-to-day experience. It's also an expression of the political environment that they've been exposed to, particularly over the last year.
Let me interject, and I'd like you to go with that a little further, but I want to interject that it also seems to be a factor with regard to specific education, with the cutoff being those people who have college degrees and those who don't. Of those people who have college degrees, 38% of the white population believes there's discrimination. For those who do not have college degrees, the figure is 65% of the population. That's just as pronounced as within 10% is pronounced as the issue with political affiliation. I'm wondering how those two are connected.
Well, they are closely linked. Indeed, after the 2016 election, we saw a stronger correlation between education levels and vote choice between Democrats and Republicans than we have in decades. Indeed, it's one of the strongest predictors of the presidential vote in 2016 was level of education. And so they are certainly linked, and they're closely aligned. And I think that what we're seeing here is a somewhat nuanced expression of how people feel about race and how whites feel about race in particular. And so you do see some linkage, right? There is some correlation between the less educated and lower-income whites are more likely to perceive racism among whites. But there's also strong regional differences that we might expect, right? Whites in the South are much more likely to perceive racism among whites than are whites outside of the South. And so the thing that I keep coming back to, and one of the big questions in 2016 as well as this year, is what's driving this sort of populism, and the populism that President Trump used as a successful political strategy, and what's sort of underlying it. Is it fundamentally economics, or is it race? And I think here we're getting some insight into that, it's not poor whites that are the most likely to perceive that they are discriminated against. It's less educated whites, but more than any other group, it's people that identify with the Republican Party. And so rather than it just being people's experience, my sense and what I'm getting from the survey data is that when people are told that they are discriminated against, when they are told that they need to be anxious, that they need to that their jobs are being taken away, whether they are or not, that's an effective strategy, and it affects how people understand race relations.
Okay. Stu, you wanted to jump in with something here.
Well, I actually disagree with Dr. Lattner a little bit on this, and I think it has to do with if you look at this data, it is true that education is a factor, but if you look at the folks who have less education, in other words, they went to work without getting a high school degree, or they went to work with a high school degree, or maybe a little bit of community college, generally those are folks who are working with their hands or with their backs. And so there's more of a perception, I think, in this data for people who've made that their life choice careers that they are discriminated against. And I think if I can just address a little bit more on that, I think if we look at this in a historic context, boy, if Lyndon Baines Johnson hadn't gotten sucked into the Vietnam War and had been able to follow through with a couple of terms to get the Great Society going, it became a remedies problem. You have rights and remedies, you know. And so what ended up happening is affirmative action became the remedy, But that had to be really coupled to overcome this problem where you had a huge percentage of the population that had the vestiges of poverty and lack of education from slavery and Jim Crow eras, where the pie didn't get any bigger. And instead of making the pie bigger to include the groups of people who had been left out of the wealth and advancement in this country, a lot of whites, particularly in the South, as Dr. Latner says, started to look at that as, well, there's somebody of color who's taking my job, taking my chance to get into a good college. And this wasn't generally everywhere, but I think if the remedies had been such that you just made the pie bigger so there were more slots in college, more slots in employment, where everybody could rise, then I think you would not have this kind of reaction.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important point, that economic inequality is something that isn't surveyed, and it's not people's economic positions. We don't know much about it from the survey data. But I think that that's absolutely an underlying factor. On the other hand, when you look at the groups, and clearly when you look at the top three areas where whites say that they have experienced themselves discrimination, right, it is jobs, it's promotions, it's college applications. And so it is this sense of opportunity. I think that Stewart is absolutely correct about that. But the question as to whether people actually have experienced discrimination, whether or not they perceive it, I think that's a different question.
Well, I'm going to jump in with an interesting side to this that I've thought about before. And Stu hit on the issue that when people who are different than me might take my job and my livelihood, all of a sudden that's a group that I'm very uncomfortable with. So if they get it and I don't, somehow I was discriminated against or I lost out. What comes to mind is I think of a country like Ireland, where the only difference between the Irish folks is whether or not they're Catholic or Protestant. So, you know, while we can argue about racial issues, we argue about other things that are different, we argue about ethnic background for people who have immigrated here, if the only difference you can find in the people who are 90% of your society is their religious difference, then you find a reason, I would think, in the case of Ireland, to basically hate the people who are different than you and their only difference is religion. We just happen to have a more diverse community here.
Well, it's not just that we have a more diverse community, but that the social and historical divisions in our society have been driven by race. Race is the divisive issue in American politics, and so that's why it can be very effectively used as a political strategy when you can feed on people's anxiety.
Yeah. Our cultural history is that we imported people of a lesser background to become our slaves or our working class, and when that didn't work anymore, we imported people across other borders to basically do the labor that no one else wanted to do.
Well, a lot of people came here on their own because there was work and there was land. And of course, the westward movement has run up against another ocean. So we're running into the fact that we have a limited set of resources and we're having to steward those more carefully as Columbus landed in Santo Domingo, I think it was the island, there were 150 million Native Americans in what is now the United States. The fact is that just that landing brought enough diseases that by the time the Pilgrims were landing, some of my forebears in Massachusetts, there were only 50 million Native Americans left because plagues had swept through the entire continent.
By our American Revolution, I think it was even half that then. It was down to 25 or 30 million. Mark, let me ask you to jump into this. When you looked at the material, were you surprised at the fact that this many people who look like you and I felt that they had been discriminated against in our society?
I was surprised by the high amount. It seemed to me that, in our society, that there's the plain fact of white privilege, and that it's largely unconscious. So I can't see that, you know, there's so many people that feel that way.
I want to explore that a little further, but I also want to remind folks that this is an open discussion that you can be part of also. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Oftentimes we have listeners that decide to stay out of the discussion because they are fascinated in enjoying what we're saying, but they may still have things to add to it. So we would like your perspective. We would like a more diverse cross-section of the Anglo population of our county to be part of this discussion, and we would like you to be part of that if you could. One of the things, as I looked at the breakdown, the largest group that were people who felt they were discriminated against when they were applying for a job. However, I was also surprised that 5% of the white population felt like they were discriminated against when they were going to a doctor or a health clinic. And 10% felt that when they interacted with law enforcement, they were also discriminated against. I looked through the study, and it was hard to get a real sense of what somebody who looks like me thinks they would be discriminated against when they get stopped by the police, other than the fact that I think is in our society, people always think that there's a good excuse for why what they did should just be forgiven, even though the other guy should not be forgiven for it. And I'm wondering how that comes up. And actually, Stu, since I realize you don't deal with criminal law on a regular basis, but you may.
Not anymore.
Anyway. Is that a factor with people who feel like, if the way I'm looked at in this is I should have gotten off with this if they'd really listened to what I said?
Well, here's what I have observed, and it's a limited slice. I think I did my last criminal defense case 25 years ago, unless you count the homeless cases where we got those dismissed. Generally, there's a couple of factors, and let me just observe. Here's four white guys talking about racism. In a community that is an island of privilege. A few years ago I ran for assembly, and I had to go all the way down to Lompoc and went to a lot of communities outside of the city of San Luis Obispo, and there's a lot of poverty out there, and there's a lot more diversity out there outside the city limits. But what I've noticed is that you have differing attitudes. If you have a city police officer, that's going to be a different attitude than a county sheriff in both of the counties that I was going to. If you have poverty, if you have somebody who is poor, they may feel discriminated against by an officer, no matter what the color or race or ethnicity of the officer is. In several of our cities here, officers don't actually live, for the most part, in the city that they patrol, and in fact make a point of living somewhere else. So that can generate attitudes and feelings where someone feels like they're not being treated fairly, and perhaps they attribute that to discrimination. But these are things that I think good training and self-awareness, particularly by officers, can overcome.
Good point. Michael, I'm going to use your notes to me from 2 weeks ago against you.
I hate debating against myself.
Well, no, actually, it's not quite that. What it really comes down to is it's a topic that I'm not sure how it fits with this, but it seemed to fit last 2 weeks ago, so maybe it fits now. And that was an observation that you felt that maybe there had been a spike in racism in the United States that may have manifested in the last election, but maybe tied to the fact that there is a fringe of the Anglo population that was still shocked and dismayed that their country would ever elect a black guy to president. So I'm wondering, that obviously affected some of your views with regard to resurgence of some racism in the country when we were talking about African Americans. Do you think that's also affecting some of the people in this country who, even though he's not in office anymore, still cannot possibly believe that this country ever elected some black guy with one parent who was a Kenyan to president of the United States?
Well, yeah, but I think it's a little more nuanced than that. The when you look at the responses to this survey, for example, when you look online at the media groups that have covered this survey and the discussion about it over the last few weeks. Breitbart is one of the organizations that picked up on NPR's coverage of this, for example. And so I think if you want to get a good idea of the people that feel that they are discriminated against and why they feel they're discriminated against when it comes to whites, this is a good place to look. And so I think that, yes, the backlash against the election of Obama is just part of this broader syndrome. And I don't want to imply that racism really surges and declines. I think rather what we see is that there is latent attitudes towards race, as Stu discussed, and they can either be activated or they can be downregulated. And when people want to use racism and racial identity as a way of mobilizing people, then they can do it because it is latent. We are hardwired to identify with tribes and groups, and which tribes and groups are a matter of political context. And so when you look at, for example, some of the reactions on Breitbart, looking at the comments to NPR's previous coverage of this, you get a pretty good idea of who are the people that feel that whites are discriminated against. So we've got one comment that says, all of the white people statues are being pulled down from Jefferson to Columbus. Try pulling down a Martin Luther King statue and see what happens. Our crime is that we love America. Most liberals are anti-white racists. You have to be retarded to be a liberal, not to mention self-loathing. If you don't think whites are under threat, you're insane, right? I mean, this is a level of anxiety that I think is being perpetuated, and people are susceptible to it.
Yeah, good point. We'll get back to that because we do have a couple of callers coming in. Let's go, Dave from Los Osos. You're on the air, Dave. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I have a couple, I guess, questions or comments. First, you may have touched on this, but my first point or question is, and I don't know if it really relates, and if it doesn't, then I'll quickly move to my second question or point, is we're not that far removed from when we were living in the wild in nature and struggling, fighting against others of other humans, or fighting against other animals to preserve our food territory. Animals still fight to the death for territory and for their mates. And so I don't know how much of a role that might play into this, that we have this, very deep-seated, kind of hardwired territorial thing, primarily probably based on resources or procreation, and that maybe it's just manifesting itself as racism, and that's just kind of the easiest way to categorize it.
I think you bring up an interesting point because we also, we are still very, I don't want to say preoccupied, but we are still driven a lot by our borders and what our borders allegedly give us for safety. Mm-hmm. I'm not worried as a Californian what's going on between here and Nevada, so the border between here and Nevada or here in Arizona doesn't bother me. But for a lot of my my co-Californians, what goes on between the Mexican border to the south is for them scary or uncomfortable, so we have to maintain those borders. I don't say that I necessarily believe we should maintain the borders, but I believe for the general view of the our society, those borders are a factor. So yeah, we're we're still into some kind of territorialism. Sometimes it's tribal, sometimes it's political. Mark, you have any thoughts on that?
I'm thinking that there's a division in terms of economics, that we see that there's poor white people that feel like that they're becoming the minority, and that the subject matter of economics is chief in my mind as far as what people are thinking about. And
you remember the movie Grapes of Wrath. You probably saw that.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we think of ourselves in terms of economic stratification, unfortunately, a lot of times. Mm-hmm. But the Soviet Union took that movie over to play in Moscow and in Russia to show people how bad things were in America. And the reaction was, poor people in America have cars, so they stopped showing it. And I think the illustration is that poor white people in America used to actually be pretty well off. And so I think to the extent that folks feel like they're going backwards economically, there is sometimes an incentive to say somebody's got to be at fault, and there's pointing of fingers. And of course, if you have a demagogue who says, "Well, it's those people of color, or those people coming over the border, or there's people who speak a different language," you know, they may get some folks following them.
Yeah, good point, David. Thank you for the call. I'm sorry, Dave. Thank you for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's see. We've got Sharon from Santa Maria. Sharon, you're on the air. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just, along that same subject, I think that white people have kind of kept silent for a long time because of all the other races feeling discriminated against. And I think in this last election, the Republicans or the Trump people have spoken out when they have been silent. And I think that's where we see it in the political parties right now. But in Santa Maria, I live in a, I'm a minority. I'm a white female in a very Hispanic population.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, I felt discriminated against, and it has more to do with being in a population that is so highly Hispanic. A lot of people don't even speak English, and to get jobs in this area, you have to be bilingual. And if you were born in America and you only spoke one language, you get discriminated against in the sense that you don't have that bilingual advantage that a lot of Spanish-speaking people that have come from out of our country, and we've taught them how to speak English when they've moved here through paying their education and given them the opportunity to learn English and to work here. But then they go into the workforce and they do take our jobs because we don't have that bilingual advantage. They get paid actually, I've worked in jobs where they get paid more than me because they're bilingual, but we have the same job discrimination. So I think a lot of that white discrimination feeling comes from things like that that aren't really spoken about.
Yeah, very good point. Thank you for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
To my guest, do you have any observations on that?
Well, yes, and I think this is a legitimate observation, and this comes back to rights and remedies. The caller has a right to have equal pay for equal work, and on the other hand, is there a remedy for Americans who've gotten their education, they've gotten into the workforce, and there is, which would be an opportunity to learn a new language, learn a foreign language so that they could, well, Spanish is not a foreign language, actually, in California. By virtue of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, this is a bilingual state. And but educating folks so that they can speak Spanish and get that extra pay is a remedy that our society should be offering.
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic example of the sort of anxiety and unfairness that that whites are expressing in this survey, and we can break this down into what is really going on here in this specific example, right? I mean, what we're really talking about is differential treatment based on language skills. And so on the one hand, we could look at that and say, well, it's not racial discrimination, it's job skill discrimination. On the other hand, there's clearly a sense that, and I think this is probably true among a lot of people in this situation, that why should white people need to learn a second language? Isn't this America, after all, right? And so that, I think, it really taps into the sense of anxiety that we're seeing in this survey, is simply being a racial minority in a community rather than the majority, that the very position that people find themselves in makes racial identity salient, and it drives anxiety among among whites.
Well, at the risk of looking at this in a way that they could cause more frustration, I'm wondering if the proximity of how long an immigrant population has been present is a factor in this. Some time ago, if you happened to be a Brit from a Germanic background and you lived in this country, the people you were most annoyed at were all the Italians that were coming in.
Sure.
But then when the Italians assimilated enough into society that you really couldn't discern them from anybody else, and you liked to eat the food they made for you, that wasn't a factor anymore. But now that we've seen over the last, even though it's been around for a long time, over the last 20 years or so, we've seen a more pronounced dialogue and teeter-totter back and forth with regard to both Hispanics entering the country and now Middle Easterners entering the country, whether or not it just happens to be what the new group is that is the one that you feel threatened by.
I think there's no question about that. I mean, when you look at historical terms, not just the Italians, but Eastern Europeans and others have been, whoever's the newest group off the boat is going to receive the brunt of derogatory and racist sentiment, right? I mean, consider yourself, Fred. You're a Jewish American. How long have Jews been considered white? That certainly wasn't always the case. But now it seems to be more the case, right?
And until it's interesting you mention that, because until the late 40s and mid 50s, universities like Harvard still looked at whether or not they had too many Jews enrolled when they looked at who they were going to let in. You can ask some of the people who worked on things like the Manhattan Project, to the day they died, talked about what schools they could or couldn't go to because they were Jewish backgrounds. There were actually people who had to talk about the fact that they were told that there were already too many Jews in Harvard, so they should find someplace else like Yale or Princeton to go to instead, and that kind of thing went on. So, yes, you bring up a good point, which I frankly wasn't going to put on the table because I think that's somewhat too personal to me and may not be personal to the population we're looking at, but thank you for bringing it up. We do have a number of calls on hold. I don't want these people having to wait too long, so I'm going to jump into those, even though we have some other directions to go on this. Jeremy from Cambria, you're on the air. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for discussing this topic. Okay. I called to offer my perspective as a white man from the South in terms of black-white racism. I was glad economics came up because Howard Zinn, in his book, A People's History of the United States, lays out a pretty good argument that racism between blacks and whites was thrust upon poor whites by rich whites because they feared they feared that poor whites could relate too much to black slaves. You know, most whites didn't have slaves. It was the slave owners who benefited from racism. Also, as a Californian now, I'd like to offer the, you know, the history that people may have forgotten that, that California was annexed illegally, that technically this is Mexico. So anyone who is racist against Mexicans in California, I think is ridiculous, and they don't know their history. I can't say that I've ever been discriminated against. I have been singled out for being white, sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time, but I bear no ill will because I think reverse discrimination is almost a necessary step towards true equality. I think what some people may perceive as discrimination is folks of color not bowing down as they always have and speaking their minds. So that's my perspective as a white man from the South.
Okay. Jeremy, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. See, we'll go to, let's see. Garland from Atascadero. You're on the air. Thank you, Garland, for waiting.
Well, thank you very much for letting me say what I wish to say. First of all, none of us really had a choice of what color we were going to be when we were born. Some were black, some were white, some were Hispanic, some were every nation that you could ever imagine. And the problem, I feel, is that we have forgotten that. And until we go back to the basics of here's who we are, and let us try to be the best we can be, whatever nationality we are, will this country ever really come together and recognize that the combination of all these people that have made this all possible?
It's a very good point. Garland, can I just interject for a second? Part of what I hear you saying, and I always want to get clarification on this, is that if I spend my time pushing you because I want you out of the way, I'm actually distracting from my own ability to just move forward.
Of course you would be.
Okay.
All right. Yes, very much.
Yeah. It's a very good point. Thank you for your call, Garland. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's see. Bill in Arroyo Grande, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to bring up the subject of white people's feelings about meritocracy and about their feelings about downward mobility.
I did keep talking.
And how that relates is that, you know, I think most white people think that they're entitled to climb the economic ladder. And our kids feel the same way. And it's not that way at all. There is such a thing as downward mobility. You know, if you choose to smoke dope and play video games, you're not going to climb the economic ladder. And maybe a brown person is willing to do the work and get higher than you are.
So you bring a very good point, Bill, and I'm wondering how that affects your resentment towards that person who makes the effort to strive and succeed.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that I do. I'm just saying that the reality is that white people aren't entitled to, you know, the better jobs if they're not willing to do the work.
It's a very good point. Thanks for the call.
And we do live in a meritocracy, at least that's what we say. And if you do the work, you'll get ahead. And if you don't do the work, you won't.
Yeah, very good point. Thank you very much, Bill.
Okay. Bill makes a very good point that kind of brings up another aspect of this. I was looking at some of the figures here, and among all white respondents to this survey, 97% had applied for a job. Now, in some communities of color, not everybody has had that opportunity like that. 98% had been employed. 66% had applied for college. And what you see with the WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and of course that's been extended to to other immigrants since, is that they come with this great reservoir of wealth and education and culture that is passed on every generation, and you can still be poor. You might be from a scion of a fine family that fell on hard times, but you still have that reservoir of culture and education, and the kids have been usually sent off to college because the parents have made sure that they could do that. And, of course, those kids have been able to get into colleges. So they always have a step up. And not everybody, as our last caller said, is going to take advantage of it. Some are going to smoke dope and play video games and throw away their advantage. But you generally start from a good place instead of growing up in a dense urban neighborhood where everybody's packing and you don't know if your kid sister's going to get shot. And you don't have any way to make a living except stealing or selling dope or things of that nature.
Yeah. Mark, you of the four of us in this conversation here at the table, you are the one who spends the most of your time deciding to be part of a community group that works specifically toward the improvement of the way of life for a minority. I'm curious, and you and I have talked about that a little bit before. For the record of people on the air, I've known Mark for a number of years. But we haven't talked much about your involvement in AACP, and I'm wondering whether or not, do you feel any kind of sort of reverse discrimination occasionally among your colleagues at NAACP? It's like, what is this liberal white guy from Los Osos doing in this discussion?
My participation with the NAACP is welcomed with open arms. A lot of the membership in the Central Coast comprises of white people. The African Americans in the group are delighted that there are white people that are choosing to become involved and to be supportive of racial minorities in the community.
So is there any – but – As a fellow white person and one of the loudmouths at the table right today, I'm wondering whether or not if I were in your shoes at the NAACP, there might be an observation, a valid observation, that Fred is very opinionated, Fred is very assertive, Fred speaks his mind, and if we really want people to pay attention to what's important for the black community, we probably need a white guy named Fred to just not talk so much. Now, I realize, by the way, just for the record, I know and you know that I talk far more than you ever will.
Absolutely.
Well, does the community as a whole look at who becomes the spokesperson, if you will, for issues and whether or not – because I suspect – some of the black members of the NAACP may walk in a room and not be paid attention to for what they have to say, but for fear of people in the room in some cases because of the racism we look at. You walk in the room and they may not want to listen to you anyway, but you're far less threatening to the population.
That's a factor. And I think in my role as a person who desires to support the NAACP is that if that's the role I'm in, then fine. Let's break the ice and get the discussion going.
Okay. Mike, you've looked at I'm pretty sure you've looked at most of the reports to this point. We've got some of them that have still been sequestered, if you will, or embargoed on this project. So we're looking at these as they come out from NPR at a national level. Do you see any correlation between what you've read about the black and Latino community and how that fits into some of the same feelings of the white community?
Well, I think that the, I mean, certainly there are some correlations, right? When you look at where people say that they're experiencing racism in terms of jobs and promotions, college applications, right? I mean, one of the fascinating things is that both people of color and whites perceive discrimination in these fields. Right now, where the differences are in the other field. So, looking at questions of police treatment and being treated differently in your neighborhood. Right, there are big differences between whites and people of color on those issues. But what I also find interesting, so opportunity is clearly something that is driving perceptions of discrimination for all racial groups. And I think that that's just as true for whites as it is for people of color. You can certainly see that in the data. One of the things where you see big differences, though, are in terms of the source of discrimination and whether or not it's individual or institutional. That is, racism that's perpetuated through laws that treat people unequally, or the court system, for example, right? And there, you see a large difference, especially among African Americans and whites, but also among Latinos and whites. People of color are much more likely to perceive discrimination institutionally. That is, that laws and procedures and courts are treating them differently. Whereas the vast majority of whites who perceive that there is discrimination against whites see it as an individual thing, right? See it as like the conversation that you two were just having in terms of being treated differently by people. And I think that is notable, that institutional racism is really not perceived much by whites. And I think that says something important about how people are experiencing racism.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. Stu, I mean, we're down to a few minutes, and I usually, as I've told you before, give you guys a couple of minutes to kind of have your own parting shots with me staying out of the way. So you're up. You've got a couple of minutes to jump in with what you think is important.
Well, I think what Dr. Lattner said is true. If I'm discriminated against in a particular situation and I don't get a job, or I don't get into a school, or I've got lots of other places to go as a white man. If you're a person of color, you may not have those other opportunities. And, you know, if I'm stuck in the justice system, I have resources, I have family resources, they make sure I get a lawyer. Somebody who's from the inner city may not have those opportunities. And so they get stuck with a public defender, and they end up being run through the system instead of defended. So those are the kinds of things. I just have a couple of quick things. The ACLU is going to be having on January 20th, 2018, at the San Luis Library, the Martin Luther King Jr. and John Bingham program, an art auction. And then I'll have the Constitution, we're going to have the Constitution Day and 19th Amendment barbecue Saturday, September 15th. Okay. So there's my
Thank you for adding that. Okay. Mark.
I think that it's in the community that we live in, we do have changing demographics, and that part of the thing about that is that it's good to adapt. It would be great to learn to speak Spanish, and that would make you more competitive in the job market. And so I think that's a factor in living in this community is being nimble and on your feet. And the community is changing, and one could adapt to that.
Good point. Okay, Michael, I generally give you the last word when you can, because you're the college professor and you can throw me out of class. a couple of observations.
Oh, well, I think that this is a great project that NPR and Harvard and Robert Wood Johnson have taken on, because as we see, particularly in these results among white Americans, there are broadly experienced perceptions of discrimination based on race. And we see not only, I think, the consequence of a lack of opportunity for people across races, but the the way that race is being used politically. We are seeing among this group, this is where white nationalism resides, and it is fundamentally not economic. It is fundamentally political, because this is the environment in which people are being exposed to racial identity cues, and it's being used to mobilize people politically, and it's something that we need to talk about.
It's a very good point. And by the way, I guess I will just say for the heck of it that you may believe that because you're a political science professor, not an economics professor. But we've talked about this before. I suspect that we don't see much break between those two lines in things either. I thank you for being part of the discussion today, and I appreciate the fact that we've had a good discussion. I wasn't quite sure how we were going to broach this topic effectively. I want to leave listeners with one side note from the report that stuck out to me that I think is very important, because there was a lot of surprise in people's parts by the fact that there were 55% of the white population who felt they'd been discriminated against. But there was one statistic that fits in a little bit differently into the study, and that is when the same population that were interviewed that felt there was 55% discrimination within their population and they'd experienced it, 84% of the respondents also said they do believe there is currently still racial and ethnic discrimination against minorities and unusual populations. So only 16% of the population at this point thinks that this doesn't exist, which means there's a more significant population of white people in the community who indeed believe and understand that there is a minority population that is still suffering from a lot of this type of thing. So I appreciated reading that particular statistic, and I appreciate you listening to me tell you about it. This is Central Coast Voices, as I've told you. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be joining the conversation again as we shift the perspective to Native American communities. Overall, the Native American portion of the report reports that substantially 75% of Native Americans to this day feel that they receive and witness discrimination against people like them on a regular basis. That'll be part of the discussion next week. She'll have a number of guests from the Native American community. As I've told you before, I'm proud to say that Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities and a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County in conjunction with KCBX Public Radio. This is Vital Signs. Vital Signs is a report that we do every 3 years. The most recent report came out in December of 2016. You can find that full report about information about at actionslo.org. The program is underwritten by a generous grant from Joan Gellert Sargent, and I appreciate her for all of her support. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. Thank you to my guests today, Mark Skinner, Dr. Michael Latner, and Stu Jenkins. It's been a wonderful program. Thank you for joining us as part of this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.